You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thousands of miles away from the battlegrounds of Iraq, the political and corporate scramble for the rights to rebuild the country's ailing infrastructure is well underway. Among the leading contenders is a private equity firm called the Carlyle Group, whose members and affiliates include, among others, former President George Bush, former Secretary of State and CIA Deputy Director Frank Carlucci, and until recently, members of the Bin Laden family. Former Carlyle employees also fill the ranks of the current administration. Recent revelations about Carlyle's influence upon key U.S. military decisions in North Korea and Iraq illuminate the extent to which private interests have secretly shaped recent U.S. foreign policy. Dan Briety, author of The Iron Triangle, Inside the Secret World of the Carlyle Group, spoke with Peace Watch about this new twist in the old dance between Wall Street and Washington.
The Carlyle Group is actually a bipartisan company, although it gets a lot of criticism for its close ties to this Republican administration. They do have some very prominent Democrats on board, Arthur Levitt, for one, the former SEC chairman under Bill Clinton, and also William Kennard, former FCC chairman under Bill Clinton. So they have hired prominent Democrats, they have hired prominent Republicans, and no, the Carlyle Group isn't the only company that is pursuing this strategy, but they have certainly perfected it, and they are unique in the extent to which they pursue it.
The tentacles of this Carlyle Group reach beyond the borders of the U.S., former presidents of Zaire and Saudi Arabian royalty. What about North Korea?
Well, their investments are heavily in South Korea, and the situation there, in the beginning of this Bush presidency, you may remember that George W. Bush took a very hard-line stance towards North Korea. Now, this was shortly following some very good work that his father had done in getting Carlyle Group some major investments in South Korea, and the whole situation started to look tenuous when it put some of those investments at risk. So George H.W. Bush sent his son a memo encouraging him to reconsider his stance towards North Korea because it was affecting, among other things, the economic stability of the region. Now, this, again, is shortly thereafter, George W. Bush did change his policy.
But that was in 2001, right?
That's right. So it's flip-flopped several times since then because of geopolitics. But at that time, it was a clear conflict of interest. George H.W. Bush should never have been advising his son on that particular policy given the investments that the Carlyle Group has in the area.
And so conflict of interest violations are not prosecutable?
No, they're not. They're just they cause outrage.
So if you're drawing a flow chart of Carlyle and its connections to the defense industry, where do the lines lead? Who are the companies? I know I read about BDM and Harsco. Who else?
Well, one of the biggest is United Defense, which we touched on a little bit earlier. United Defense is the maker of the Bradley fighting vehicles, the Paladin gun systems. This is a company that Carlyle took public in December of 2001, shortly after the September 11th attacks, when it became clear that defense spending was going to really go through the roof, and they still own 50% of the company. And you know, United Defense has been everywhere in the past 6 months. I mean, you saw President Bush gave a speech at the United Defense plant in Santa Clara shortly after he made his dramatic landing on the USS Abraham Lincoln. And you know, here was George W. Bush giving a speech thanking the United Defense workers, a company that his father's company owns. So you know, there's a nice little advertisement for the Carlyle Group. So the defense holdings range from everything from companies like United Defense that actually make weapon systems and things like that, to a lot of aerospace companies that make parts for different fighter jets and things of that nature. There's also a lot of security investments, companies like United States Investigative Services, which is a company that does background checks and provides security clearance and different levels of security clearance for government employees and airline employees and things like that.
So the big picture, how far-reaching is Carlyle into the world of defense and military contracting? Do they own 75% of it?
Oh, no. Nothing even close to that. I mean, Northrop Grumman, TRW, these are the companies that that are the big heavy hitters in defense, Lockheed Martin, folks like that. But Carlyle, with all of their investments together, is the 11th largest defense contractor in the U.S., and they also have been expanding internationally. They just bought the Ministry of Defense research arm called Kinetech in the U.K., which is essentially the same as DARPA here in the U.S., and they've also bought the defense and aerospace assets of Fiat in Italy, and they're maneuvering to buy the aerospace assets of Daimler Chrysler in Germany. So they're getting more international.
Mm. In your chapter on the cast of characters, you mentioned former U.S. Representative Cynthia McKinney, but she's listed as a critic of the Carlyle Group. Did Carlyle contribute in any way to her controversial political demise?
Well, I think so, but I think Ms. McKinney also contributed to it. What ended up happening in that situation is after September 11th, Cynthia McKinney was hitting on a raw nerve in the U.S. in that she was pointing out that friends of the Bush family, in fact the Bush family, stand to gain financially from the war on terrorism. Now, the way she went about doing it was probably not the best way. She made a very sweeping accusation that possibly George W. Bush had allowed the events of September 11th to happen. Now, this is a suspicion that other people have had. It's not a totally foreign suspicion, but since she didn't have proof of anything, it really was a conspiracy theory at that point. And the Carlyle Group was able to very handily dismiss her comments by just saying, I think the spokesperson for the Carlyle Group said, did she say this while standing on a grassy knoll in Roswell, New Mexico, which gives you an idea of how easily dismissible a conspiracy theory like that is. And in some ways, it does a disservice to what the real story of the Carlyle Group is, which is this revolving door in Washington.
Mm-hmm. So you have investigated the matter, and you just come to the conclusion, basically, that they are a revolving door, and they didn't have any prior knowledge. What conclusion did you come to?
Yeah, no, I don't think that they had any prior knowledge of September 11th, and I certainly don't think that our president allowed September 11th to happen. What I do think is that right now the father of the president needs to recuse himself from the Carlyle Group because of the conflicts of interest, and that we see that through this war profiteering, you see an undermining of the credibility in government from the American people, and I think that that's a very dangerous thing.
Mm-hmm. Some of your work and conclusions, nonetheless, are quite controversial in this very heated political climate that we're living in now. What kind of response have you gotten to your book?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. I think people were craving this kind of research and this kind of look into how a company like the Carlyle Group operates. Certainly, the Carlyle Group is unhappy with the portrayal of the company, but it's obvious that they've been undergoing a real image change over the past few months. First of all, by promoting or kicking Frank Carlucci upstairs to become chairman emeritus and hiring Lou Gerstner to become chairman. And also, they've just redesigned their website to be more transparent and show more of their investments. They've also hired a new spokesperson, which they never had before. So they've been working very hard to change their image, and they were certainly aware that it needed changing.
Dan Briotti, any final thoughts on your part?
Just that, you know, I think that it's important for people to keep their eye on the ball when it comes to this story. It's very easy to run off on these conspiracy theories because you've got the Bushes, you've got the Bin Ladens, you've got George W. Bush, the current president, the former president. So it's very easy to get very caught up in those big names. But I think that people should remember that what this story is about is money and politics and how the two have become very intertwined in our democracy over the past, you know, 10, 20, 30 years now. And I think that the American public has become too accepting of this way of life, and we need to take a hard look at it and try to turn things around. Let's understand what's happening, and let's try to make a change.
That was Dan Briotti, author of The Iron Triangle, Inside the Secret World of the Carlyle Group. Last week, the Alaska State Legislature passed a bipartisan resolution opposing the USA Patriot Act, citing concerns that the federal anti-terrorism bill could infringe on privacy and individual freedoms. The legislature used strong language advising law enforcement and state agencies not to, quote, initiate, participate in, or assist, or cooperate with an inquiry, investigation, surveillance, or detention without reasonable suspicion of criminal activity under Alaska state law. Unquote. Following Hawaii's lead, Alaska is the 114th resolution of its kind to pass in cities, towns, and counties around the country. Speaking recently at a conference at the University of Massachusetts in Boston entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights, Nancy Talalian, co-founder of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, discussed the growing grassroots campaign to restore civil liberties in the U.S.
Quoting from one of Boston's most famous residents, Benjamin Franklin, who said, "They that can give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." On September 11th, Americans lost a sense of security from terrorist attack, but as you've heard, soon afterward we lost a different sense of security: freedom of speech, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, freedom from detention without probable cause, and the right to a speedy and public trial. We've moved dangerously far away from open government. And the increase in government secrecy also makes us feel less secure. The more the government says, "Just trust us," the less we feel inclined to do so. Clearly, the situation we're in demands that we take action, and that's what I'm going to talk about. In Northampton, in November of 2001, which was just a few weeks after the Patriot Act was passed, a small group of us were comparing the current situation with COINTELPRO, McCarthyism, the internment of the Japanese Americans in California in World War II, and the Palmer Raids, all of which you've heard about today. We knew we had to take action. But if you remember the climate, Ashcroft's infamous quote that basically said, if you dare to question what we're doing, then you're nothing but a terrorist yourself. We knew there were a few small pockets of people scattered around the country, but few people had actually heard of the Patriot Act, or if they had, they figured it wouldn't affect them, so it didn't matter. But even though the Patriot Act was passed by the federal government, it was having its impact on many innocent people in their local communities, and it relied on local law enforcement. So we decided that that was where we would act first. Our goals were to educate the community, collaborate with our local government, pass a resolution that stated what we saw as the problems, and to protect civil liberties of the local people, and then expand the movement and ultimately meet with Congress people at the national level to present the resolution and ask for their leadership in amending the Patriot Act and executive orders. So in Northampton, we organized ourselves as the Northampton Bill of Rights Defense Committee. We collected more than 1,000 petition signatures from Northampton residents, and we worked with the city councilors on a resolution and mobilized the community to show their support. The resolution was passed unanimously. We ask that the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, the State Police, and any other federal, state, and local law enforcement report to the City Council the extent and manner to which they have acted under the USA Patriot Act and new executive orders, including disclosing the names of any detainees held in the area, the charges lodged against each detainee, the name of counsel representing each detainee, the number of search warrants executed in the city without notice to the subject of the warrant, the extent of electronic surveillance carried out in the city under powers granted under the USA Patriot Act, the extent to which federal authorities are monitoring political meetings and religious gatherings, the number of times education records have been obtained, and the number of times library records and records of book purchases have been obtained, and the subpoenas issued to Eugene citizens through the United States Attorney's Office without a court's approval or knowledge. We resolve that to the greatest extent legally possible, no city resources will be used for unconstitutional activities conducted under the USA Patriot Act or recent executive orders. And I have a little side note about the Eugene effort. A few weeks before their vote by the city council, the city councilors told the organizers, who'd worked very hard for many months, "We're not going to vote on your resolution. We're going to do a letter. And whatever city councilors decide to sign it can do so, but we're not going to vote on the resolution." So I got a panic-stricken call. "What are we going to do now?" I said, "Well, use your base," which is what they did. They had the base, hundreds of people call their city councilors, and they showed up the night of the vote, more than 400 strong in the city council chambers, and had many impassioned speeches before the meeting. The headline the next morning read, "Eugene City Council gives in to a stampede of residents, surprising even themselves by voting unanimously for a civil liberties resolution." Well, each resolution that passes inspires people in other communities to organize. People like the movement because it is truly bottom-up, grassroots democracy. Great ideas come from every community, and each resolution is better and stronger than the one before it. It also exercises the rights that are now threatened, or as Gandhi said, become the change that you seek. However, real success, of course, is only going to come when Congress and the American people truly believe that the Bill of Rights has to be respected and adhered to. And as Ben Franklin said, we can't buy our safety by forfeiting our civil liberties or those of immigrant populations. So I'll talk a little bit about the impact thus far. The movement has been growing much faster lately, and fortunately we seem to be in at least a little bit more hospitable climate than we were back in October of 2001 when the Patriot Act was passed. Last year, as you've heard, the National ID card and the official TIPS program were deleted by Dick Armey, and Congress has at least put a few stumbling blocks in the path of the Defense Department's Total Information Awareness Program. We've seen resistance to the Patriot II Act from many parts of the political spectrum, and Republican Congressman James Sensenbrenner, who is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, assured us that Orrin Hatch's amendment to eliminate the Patriot Act's sunset provisions would have to pass over his dead body. Senator Hatch has quietly withdrawn his amendment, for the time being at least. The resolutions are moving from progressive to mainstream communities. And as for federal legislation to amend the Patriot Act, in March, as some of you may have heard earlier, Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont introduced H.R. 1157, the Freedom to Read Protection Act, which would require the FBI to show probable cause before requesting bookstore and library records. The bill currently has 78 co-sponsors, and we think that the grassroots movement will help ensure that this bill passes and hopefully will be the first of many such bills. We also want to ensure that there will be an open, productive national debate about the Justice Department's draft of the Domestic Security Enhancement Act, Patriot II, and any other proposed bills that threaten liberties. And again, the presence of a growing grassroots movement should help. We've been seeing organizations also use resolutions to make statements. The American Library Association passed a resolution. Various unions have done so. And universities and religious organizations have passed resolutions as well. I think that the grassroots movement can help make more people aware of the dangers of rolling back rights. Gradually, people are becoming better informed about the movement and the issues. So I hope that you will organize in your communities or on your campuses if you're not already, and I look forward to hearing about your progress. I want to say that the important thing is don't be afraid to start. Every city and state effort so far has begun with just one or two or a very small handful of people, and yet it's grown to encompass the liberties of 8 million. Each of these people have been able to awaken thousands of their fellow residents and convince their government bodies to the dangers that we face and the importance of taking action. So I'll close now with a quote that I use to describe the committees across this country that are working to protect the civil liberties of the people in their community and nationwide, several of whom are here today. It's by Margaret Mead. "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has."
That was Nancy Tilalian, co-founder of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. She spoke at a conference in Boston entitled "War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights." Special thanks to Mark Weaver at community radio station WMBR for production assistance with that piece. With the video game industry surpassing the movie industry in profits of well over $4 billion a year, the biggest ever video game convention was recently held in Los Angeles, featuring a large display of military games. The game expo, known as E3, included a game marketed by the U.S. Army. KPFK's Fidel Rodriguez went to the expo and asked participants and game makers if video games are having a violent influence on youth. Ironically, though, many of the games are marketed for young adults. The E3 Expo was for persons 18 and over, with no children allowed.
I am in the E-Expo, entertainment, or should I say electronic and entertainment convention. It's the biggest video game and electronic convention in the world. I essentially am in the Matrix. This has got to be the biggest matrix of technology that I've ever witnessed. They said that they pumped in about $100 million into the L.A. Convention Center to set up the whole structure. I mean, this place has been completely redone. I'm here to come and check out and see what some of the new videos are and what is the theme of a lot of them. A lot of people have been saying the theme is pushing sex and violence, and that's what I'm going to come and find out. I'm going to come and interview some people. One of the most appalling things to me that I've seen has been the romanticism of the United States military. The United States Army actually has a video game out. We're going to go and talk to them. And I'm actually in front of a video game right now that is called Metal Gear Solid, The Twin Snakes. It's actually a video game that you play a terrorist and you go out and try to take some people out. And it's very graphic in many different forms, whether it's dealing with sexual issues or it's dealing with violent issues. It's all about, how do I kill? How do I train to kill? What type of weaponry do I use? Do I use knives? Do I use sticks? Do I use guns? Do I use bombs? I'm going to come and talk to some people. Let's try to get some insight on this whole video technology era that is sweeping the world and definitely influencing our youth. Let's go find out how much it's influencing. Do you think any of these games are actually having influence around or on youth pertaining to violence?
Not really. I think it's all about maintaining. I mean, I think what video games allow is for you to go into the fantasy world, the fantasy realm, and act out whatever inclinations you might have, even though I don't have any violent inclinations usually. And if I do, I take them out on an inanimate object, just when you're frustrated with something that doesn't work. But I don't think it adds, personally, I don't believe it adds to violence in society. Unless there's something else lacking already in that person's life, the game might act as a catalyst to further that, but I don't think it actually is the starting point or even necessarily something that pushes people over the edge to act out in a violent way.
All right, I'm in front of a game called Killswitch by Namco, which is a looks like a military operation. Killswitch is an innovative military shooter that emphasizes realistic covert tactics and awesome firepower to the ultimate experience in combat gaming. Featuring the unique offensive covert system and utilizing the blindfold combat mechanic, Killswitch demands that use of modern warfare tactics, forcing players to utilize surrounding environments and quickly adjust on the fly through each intense and challenging missions. Spread out over 18 different levels that feature environments from Middle Eastern deserts to an underground submarine base.
What's up, man? Your homeboy right here is playing Killswitch right now.
Right.
And it's a, you know, it's a military action game.
Right.
Do you think these type of games have any type of influence around over kids, you know, and influencing them maybe or adding to other, like, problems they might be going through to act out in violence?
Personally, I feel that this is, for me personally, it's used as a vent. Like, if I have anger or, like, frustration I need to let off, this would be a perfect game to play. That way I don't go out and do it. like, you know, in real life. So, no, I, for me, no.
Under the Call of Duty brand name, games will be developed for both the PC and console systems. Each version will stand alone as a separate and distinctive game experience. And, you know, they got, so they got some old Jeeps here. If I was of Jewish descent, I would kind of be pissed. They got a couple guys walking around dressed up as Nazis with guns in front of this game, Call of Duty. Do you think it has any type of influence over kids?
No.
Do you have children?
Pardon?
Do you have children?
Yes, I do.
Would you all let, what's a good age bracket for this game right here?
We let the ratings board decide that. You know, the game will be rated before it's put into stores, and we follow the ratings. So,
okay. All right, great.
Follows the ratings board. Things work well.
All right, thanks a lot, man.
All right. Pleasure.
Do you think video games influence youth in terms of violence?
Yes, absolutely.
You think they...
I absolutely do, and I've been working in this industry for 6.5 years. So, you know, it's a problem.
Think about the Army getting involved in video games for kids.
Well, it pays my paycheck. Yeah. I work for the ad agency that's doing the advertising for the game, so it helps to put food on my table, so I'm for it in that way. Other than that, in terms of a recruiting tool, I think it's a really, really smart recruiting tool they should have used a long time ago. However, people play video games. There's lots and lots of death and killing and risks taken and, you know, crazy stunts done and things that are completely unrealistic. And those same people are going to play America's Army and think, oh, this is, you know, if I join up for the Army, it's going to be all shooting and fun and, you know, jumping off helicopters and all kinds of, you know, wild and crazy things that aren't risk, you know, aren't going to hurt you. Your thumb is the worst thing that's going to get hurt. And so, you know, that is a question. The one thing about these Army games, Special Forces games, and the other games, I mean, you are killing real people. And the objectification of other nations and cultures is a concern. Because, you know, this whole booth was made based on, you know, the desert wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And, you know, these are real people getting killed. These are real families getting torn apart. These are real lives being ruined. These are real, you know, entire nations that are living under, you know, are going to have to live after the war-torn thing. So, you know, that's something real that we need to think about. It's not just a game. I don't like violence. I don't support the war personally. But then again, I love my business, and I wouldn't go somewhere else because of that. But I have worked with people who have left the computer games industry because they do not support the violence and the sexuality, and there's a lot of all kinds of exploitation of women, and there's all kinds of stuff that, and I know people who have left the industry because of that. I will not do that because I have a fun job, and not everyone does.
That was KPFK's Fidel Rodriguez reporting from the E3 Expo video game conference in Los Angeles. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, Andrea Jordan, Pete Weiss, and Benta Berkland. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.